inelastic scattering process for electrons scattering off of some proton fixed targets. We did it once in kind of a general setup where we knew nothing. Here we're going to put in the fact that a proton is made out of quarks, and we're going to do the same calculation in the parton model. So it's straightforward to compute the matrix element, and then we squared it. And now we can plug in and compute the cross-section, parton level cross-section. So that would be sigma hat. So I need to write down 2EL times 2EP times VREL. And I want to integrate over the final state momenta. Here is the general formula for the cross-section. We can do the integral over p using the spatial part of the momentum conserving delta function. Then we're left with the following expression. 1 over, so I can express, I'm going to try to express as many things as possible in terms of the Mandelstam variables. So I'm left with 2 s hat squared. I should say we're going to be evaluating this in the center of mass frame. One over 2 s squared, I still have an integral over L prime. And then I have 2 pi. I'm left with the energy conserving delta function, which sets the square root of s hat equal to 2L prime, 2EL prime. And then I have 1/4 times the matrix element squared. So in terms of the integral over L prime, the integral over phi is trivial. The integral over the energy, EL prime, I can evaluate using the delta function. And then I just have one integral left over, which is the integral over cosine theta. So at the end of the day, I have let's see, 1 over 16 pi times s hat, and an integral over cosine theta, and then 1/4 times the matrix element squared. So I can plug in for the matrix element squared with right above. And I have a differential cross-section. D sigma hat by d cos theta is equal to e to the 4th qq squared over 16 pi s hat t hat squared times s hat squared plus u hat squared. Okay. Now I can I can simplify this a little bit using the fine structure constant alpha. I have alpha squared uq squared times pi over s hat t hat squared s hat squared plus u hat squared. Okay. Now I want to do a couple of substitutions to express it just in a slightly different form in terms of different variables. The hat, right. So the hat has to do with parton level quantities. And essentially, there's no real difference. It just is what you think it is. This is a cross-section, but it just happens to be the cross-section for scattering off of a quark, i.e. off of a parton. The Mandelstam variables of the hats are also, you know, legitimate Mandelstam variables just defined with in terms of the parton level momenta. So for example, S hat is the quark momentum little p plus L, the electron momentum squared. T hat is just L minus L prime squared or Q squared. And then U hat is P minus L prime squared. Okay, so it's just a way of distinguishing the Mandelstam variables at the quark level from the Mandelstam variables at the hadron level in terms of the proton momentum. Now, let's do a little bit of change of variables. So T hat is, okay, so I wrote the expression there. I can also write it as minus 2 L dot L prime. And so it's 2 times EL's EL prime with a minus sign, 1 minus cosine theta. And then in the center of mass frame, I can write this as minus 1 half S hat 1 minus cosine theta. So this allows me to express dt hat is 1 half s hat d cosine theta. So I can write d sigma hat by dt hat. This will give me, so it's just what I wrote before, times the Jacobian factor. So this will end up being 2 pi alpha squared qq squared over s hat squared t hat squared times s squared plus u hat squared. Okay, so I just took my expression that I had before and I just have to multiply it by 2 over s hat. And so that's how I get this. All right. So now we're going to go from parton level quantities to hadron level quantities. So we have, first of all, t hat was equal to q squared. Of course, q is just defined in terms of the lepton momenta. And so that part doesn't really care about whether we're talking about parton level or hadron level. And this is just the same quantity minus q squared that we introduced before. We also have little p, so this is the four momentum of the incoming quark. And we also defined a momentum, a big P, which is the four momentum of the initial proton. And so what we're going to do is make kind of an approximation or an assumption that the quark will carry some fixed fraction of the total proton momentum. And so what we say is that there's something called the Strzok quark. Here we're computing a cross-section for one particular quark. The Strzok quark is just the one that gets scattered by the photon in the process. But of course, the proton is a collection of lots of different quarks as well. So there's one that participates in the hard scattering process, that is the Strzok quark. So the Strzok quark that interacts with the photon carries a fraction x of the total proton momentum. So what we're doing is we're writing little p is equal to x times big P, where now x is some quantity between 0 and 1. Now, obviously, this kind of assumption doesn't really make sense for a proton at rest. The quark is moving around relativistically inside of the proton. But if you have a proton at rest, obviously, this is not going to be satisfied. This relation only really makes sense if you imagine a frame in which the proton itself is moving relativistically. And so in that case, you can basically just neglect any of the transverse momentum that the quark has as it moves around inside of the proton and just assume it's also moving relativistically in the same direction as the proton is moving. Okay. So now that we can relate these two momenta to each other, we can relate the hadron-level quantities to the parton-level quantities. So first of all, let's solve for x. So we're neglecting all of the quark masses. And so that tells me that p squared, little p squared is equal to 0, little p prime squared is equal to 0. So I can write down little p prime squared. And by conservation of momentum, this is just p plus l minus l prime. And if I square it, and if I expand it out, I have p squared plus l minus l prime squared. Then there's a cross term, which is 2 p dotted into l minus l prime. So I can write this in terms of q. This is p squared plus q squared plus 2 p dot q. So p prime squared and p squared are both 0. And so I get an expression that 0 is equal to p dotted into q plus q squared. So now I can relate little p to big P. Just introduce a factor of x. And so I have x big P dotted into q. I forgot a 2 here. And then I have plus q squared. And I can just solve this equation for x. So I have x is equal to minus q squared over 2 p dot q, or I could write this as big Q squared over 2 p dot q. So you can see that this is exactly the same x we had before, Bjorkian x. So in the parton, at the parton level, little x has a different meaning compared to at the hadron level, but it's the same quantity. It is the momentum fraction of the struck quark. At the hadron level, remember, it was kind of a measure of how inelastic the collision was. If x was equal to 1, it would be elastic. And if x is between 0 and 1, then it's inelastic. This is the same x as before. OK, and then the last. Well, I should say not last, but we need a couple of other relations too. So next I want to relate the center of mass energy at the parton level, s hat is l plus p squared, to the center of mass energy squared at the hadron level. So if I expand this out, because everything is massless, the quarks and the electron, I just have 2L dot P. And so this is 2L dotted into big P times X. And when we looked at this, when we looked at scattering at the hadron level, we were also taking the relativistic limit in which the energies were all much larger than the proton mass. And so this quantity here, 2L dot P, is just S at the hadron level. So this is just X times S. Okay, so that's one variable. I also want to define Y. So Y was defined as P dot Q over P dot L. And these were defined at the hadron level. So these are the proton momenta. And so I can write this as X times P dot Q over X times P dot L. The X's will cancel off. And so I have So I have P dot Q over P dot L. Now let me write Q as the momentum transfer. I had written it as L minus L prime, but I could also write it as P prime minus P. And then I want to divide by P dotted into L. So the term where I have P squared will give me 0, since the quark mass is assumed to be 0. And I'll just have P dot P prime over P dot L. So if I introduce a factor of 2 here, this quantity in the numerator is minus P hat, and the quantity in the denominator is just S hat. So in other words, P hat is equal to minus Y times S hat. And S hat, according to this relation, is X times S. So this is X, Y times S. And then lastly, I need U hat as well. So this is minus S hat minus T hat, since all of the masses are 0 at the parton level. And so this is minus S, X, 1 minus Y, and that's it. Okay. So then the next thing that I want to do is, and this will be the last thing, is I want to write my differential cross-section with respect to y instead of t hat. So I want to just write down d sigma hat dy. And so this is d sigma hat by dt hat times dt hat minus dy. There's one slightly subtle thing. It's not really too deep. But because t has this negative sign when you relate it to y. This one here. When you compute this derivative, you'll get something negative. And so we'll introduce another minus sign to cancel that off. It's equivalent to just flipping the limits of integration. So instead of integrating from t min to t max, if you express that in terms of an integral over y, you'd be integrating from y max to y min. So just flipping the limits of integration around, you'll have an extra minus sign. So let me just fix that by introducing an absolute value. And it's the same reason you have an absolute value when you take a Jacobian. So let me so we can plug this in, just taking the derivative here. So dt hat by dy is equal to x times s. And so I'm left with the following, 2 pi alpha squared qq squared over q to the fourth. And then I have y squared plus 2, 1 minus y. This should be squared. Let's see. This is, I don't think I have this correct in my notes. Oh, sorry. No, I think this is right. Be like this. So all I did was plug in, so what's in parentheses is just s hat squared plus y hat squared, and then I substitute in, express it in terms of y, and simplified it a little bit, and this is what you get. Okay. So this is still the parton level cross section, and the thing that we need to do next is figure out how to turn this into a hadron level cross section. So remember, using factorization, the cross-section went like the product of three different terms. There was the probability of finding a quark with a given momentum. So that part we haven't talked about yet. There was the parton-level cross-section. That's what we just computed. And the last ingredient was just the probability to hadronize. And by computing the inclusive cross-section, the probability of hadronization was equal to 1. So that part is essentially trivial. So the part left over that we need to figure out is what is the probability for finding a quark with a given momentum inside of the proton. So we want to find the probability for finding a quark Q inside proton with a given momentum. And we would set up the problem not in terms of the momentum of the quark, but in terms of the momentum fraction of the quark. So we can ask, what's the probability for finding this quark with a given momentum fraction, x. And so this probability is denoted by a function. So fq of x times dx. Of course, momentum is a continuous variable. And so all we can ask is, what is the probability for quark q to have momentum between x and x plus dx. So that's given by this function, f of q of x. And this function here, f of q, is known as the parton distribution function. Also known as a PDF. So this is the probability that we want. Now we can compute the hadron level cross section. So EP goes to EX, the inclusive scattering process. So we have our parton level cross section. The probability of hadronization will sum to 1, since this is inclusive. Now we just need to multiply by the probability of finding our parton with a given momentum. And then the last step is we just want to sum over all possible quarks and all possible momenta. So we have to sum over the different quarks we can have, and then just integrate over x. So let me write it like this, between 0 and 1. And so this is the hadron level cross section. Okay, so there we go. We can also express this as a differential cross-section. So I could write d sigma by dx. This would just be a sum over q. I have fq of x and then sigma hat. Or I can express it in as a doubly differential cross-section. So if I write down d sigma, d squared sigma, dx, dy, this is a sum over q, f of q of x. And then nothing here depends on y. The only thing that sigma hat is an integral over y. And so if I want to write a differential cross-section in terms of y, I should write down d sigma hat by dy, like this. So this quantity, this doubly differential cross-section at the hadron level, is exactly what we computed before in our general analysis. And so this is the two. These are the two things we can compare at the hadron level and at the parton level. So before we do that comparison, I just want to give you a little bit of a sense of what these PDFs mean. So if you ask what quarks make up a proton, you know, the standard answer is that, you know, you take two u quarks and a d quark, and that is a proton. But it's too simplistic. The real answer is actually much more subtle. Not more subtle, but more complicated. U, and d are what are known as valence quarks. So these are just the valence quarks. But we can also have QQ bar pairs that fluctuate from the vacuum. And these are known as C quarks. So the heuristic picture of what's going on is we have a proton. It's made up of a U, and a D. And okay, so I have three valence quarks going along as the proton propagates. But as it goes, there's constantly quantum fluctuations. For example, there would be gluons, like so. In addition, one of those gluons might fluctuate into a QQ bar pair. So for example, I might have a gluon that may turn into a U quark and an anti U quark, which will then annihilate and then go back to a gluon like this. I could also have other types of quarks, even quarks that are, you know, technically not allowed in the proton, like strange quarks. So I might have an S, S bar, or even heavier quarks can also appear as well. So these quarks here in these loops are C quarks. So if you just sort of, if you could possibly take a snapshot of the proton at this, you know, point here, you don't just have three quarks. You have, I guess, four quarks and one antiquark. When you scatter off of a quark, so let's say your photon was scattering off of an up quark, did it scatter off of one of the valence quarks or did it scatter off of a C quark? There's no way of knowing that because it's equivalent. Okay, so the photon can scatter off of valence or C quarks. And that includes antiquarks as well. A photon could scatter off of a U-bar in the proton. Doesn't just have to scatter off of a quark. So when you sum over all possible quarks Q, you're not just summing over U, U, and D, but you have to sum over all flavors, every type of quark. All right. So these functions f, the PDFs, are not objects that you can compute from first principles. They have to do with the non-perturbative dynamics of QCD, but they can be measured experimentally. And once you measure those functions, then you can compute, in principle, any process that you like. So I just want to sketch what these functions look like. So we'll just do a sketch of, well, typically what's plotted is not f of x, but x times f of x, and as a function of x. And so here will be 1, here will be 0.5, and this is 0. And then for the x direction, it's plotted as a log scale. So we have 1, 0.1, 0.01, and then 0.001, like this. So I'm just going to sketch what these functions look like. So let's do, first of all, the u-quark. Well, it looks something like this. And so this is u. The d-quark looks something like this. And then we have D bar, looks something like this. And then U bar, looks something like that. And you have like this. So this would be S, and it's equal to the S bar. And you have C, the same as C bar. And you also have B, the same as B bar. And then for T, it would be very, very tiny. Okay, so heavy quarks, so first of all, heavy quarks do exist inside of the proton. Even quarks like the bottom quark and the charm quark, which are, you know, heavier than the proton is itself, they exist as virtual quarks inside the proton. The other thing to note is that at high momentum fraction, so, okay, you know, at larger values of x, most of the momentum is carried by the u quark and the d quark. Okay, so that makes sense that the valence quarks are carrying most of the momentum at high x. Now, the reason that this quantity x times f of x is interesting is because if you integrate over this quantity, that just gives you the total fraction that's carried by that particular quark. So it turns out that if you integrate over all of these different curves and add them together, it does not give you 1. It's not equal to the total momentum of the entire proton. It's not equal to the total momentum fraction. And the reason is that it actually gives you a number around 0.5. And so the statement is that only around half of the momentum of the proton is carried by the quarks. But there's something important that we left out, the gluons. So the gluons also carry a very large fraction of the momentum. Gluons are also partons, and so they would also have a PDF, and it would look something like this. This would be the PDF for the gluons. And especially at low values of x, the gluon PDF is very, very large. In our particular calculation, because we're considering a leptonic probe, which couples to the proton by interactions with the photon, we don't need to consider gluon, the gluon PDF, because the gluon doesn't carry electric charge and doesn't interact with the proton. Okay. So the glue on PDFs are not going to be important for what we'll talk about today, but the glue on PDFs we're going to return to because it turns out that the glue on PDFs are the most important PDFs for production of Higgs bosons at the LHC. So we're going to talk about that process, and the glue on PDFs will be crucial. So let's write down again this doubly differential cross section. Let's just go back to the formula that I had written down. This one. So I had d squared sigma for scattering off of a proton. This is sum over q, fq of x, d sigma hat I dy. And now if I plug in the expression that we derived for this differential cross-section at the parton level, we get the following results. We have a sum over q. We have x, f of q of x. And then we have 2 pi alpha squared uq squared times s over q to the fourth times y squared plus 2, 1 minus y. Like this. So now we can compare this to the expression we got before when we did the general calculation. Here's what we found. We found that this cross-section is equal to 2 pi alpha squared over q to the fourth. And it was dependent on two functions, f1 of e of x and q squared times x, y squared. And then we had 2 f1 of e x and q squared times 1 minus y. So this is the formula. We might have derived this on Wednesday, I think. So now we can read off what these functions f1 and f2 are. In terms of the PDFs, so we have one F1E of x in q squared times x is equal to f2 of e of x in q squared is equal to the sum over q x q squared fq of x. And just to be explicit, let me expand out what's on the right-hand side. So I need to sum over all of the different quarks that it might scatter off of. So I have x. So first of all, it could scatter off of an up quark. So I have 2/3 squared times fu of x. It could scatter off of a u bar. U bar has charge minus 2/3. If I square it, I'll still have 2/3 squared. So I would write it like this. It could scatter off of a d. Or a d bar. It could scatter off of a strange quark. Plus dot dot dot. Thank you. So now let's summarize. When we did the general calculation, we had two arbitrary functions, f1 and 2 of x and q squared. The reason that it depended on two variables is because it was an inelastic scattering process. And so an inelastic scattering process is two, we argued, two independent kinematic variables. But at the level of the, at the parton level, we can see what is implied for these two arbitrary functions. So first of all, so we have the parton level calculation. And it relied on the fact that the proton is made from spin 1/2 quarks. That was our assumption. We have two very interesting facts. So fact number one is that these arbitrary functions, which are functions of two variables, only depend on one variable. So you can see that in our, you know, arbitrarily they're defined in terms of x and q squared. Nothing here on the right-hand side depends on q squared. So these functions, f1 and 2e of x and q squared, are only functions of x and not of q squared. And so this fact here is known as Bjorkane scaling. The meaning of Bjorkane scaling is easy to understand. So for an inelastic collision, there's two independent kinematic variables. For an elastic collision, there's only one. Remember, if you write down a 2-to-2 scattering process, you only need one independent variable, such as the Mandelstam T variable, in addition to the center of mass energy. We're not talking about that. So secretly, this inelastic scattering process at the fundamental level is really just elastic scattering. And so that's what the parton level calculation is telling us. Secretly, we have elastic scattering processes going on. The photon is the electron is scattering elastically off of the point-like constituents in the proton, which means that there is really only one underlying kinematic variable. And so that's the meaning of the fact that these functions only depend on one variable and not two. So it's elastic scattering. We could say the underlying scattering process is elastic. So there's only one independent variable. And then fact number two is that simply that the functions f1 and f2 are not independent but are related to each other. So there's a relation that x times f1 of e of x is equal to f2 e of x. And this is known as the Kallen-Gross relation. Fact number one just has to do with the fact that the constituents, the partons inside the proton, are point-like. Fact number two tells us something about the nature of those point-like constituents. We assume that they were spin 1/2, and that's the reason that we got this relation. If you assume, make a different assumption about the spin, then you'll get a different Kallen-Gross relation. Okay, so you'll have to check that in one of your homework problems. Okay, so historically, deep inelastic scattering measurements were very important, of course, to establishing evidence for quarks. And it was done before we even knew that QCD was the correct theory. So what these scaling relations told us is that, you know, hadrons are made out of point-like constituents that make them up. But then the theory of QCD came along, and it's perfectly consistent with everything that we've described. It says that the theory of the strong interaction involves quarks, which are confined together inside of hadrons, but the quarks themselves are point-like, and they interact as free particles over short distance scales inside of the hadron. And that's consistent with the idea of asymptotic freedom. So the last point that I want to make is that everything that we've done so far has been at lowest order in the strong coupling constant, zeroth order. We haven't involved any gluon fields at all. If you do include higher order corrections to this calculation, you do find that Bjorkane scaling no longer holds. And this goes under the name of what are called scaling violations. So these are order alpha s QCD corrections. B2 violation of Bjorkane scaling. In other words, these functions f1 and f2 at order alpha s will depend on q squared. But these scaling violations, you can compute them in a perturbative way, since again they have to do with the short distance dynamics, which so in that limit QCD is asymptotically free, and so one can compute these scaling violations, and they perfectly match with what's measured experimentally for these functions f1 and f2. So the scaling violations are in agreement. With experimental data. Okay. Are there any questions on this? This concludes the portion on deep inelastic scattering. So, but we still have a few minutes left. But if there's any questions on this, I can answer those before I move on. Okay. So our next topic is going to be Higgs physics, and we're going to talk about Higgs decays and production. First, we're going to talk about Higgs decays. And when we talk about Higgs production after that, we're going to focus in particular on Higgs production in hadron colliders, such as the Large Hadron Collider. So the Higgs boson has the largest couplings to fields with the largest mass. That was the prediction of the Higgs mechanism itself, that there's this extra degree of freedom, the Higgs boson, and its couplings to all of the other Standard Model fields is proportional to the mass of those fields. In the Standard Model, the heaviest particles are the W, the Z, and the top quark. Higgs boson has been observed experimentally, and its mass has been measured. So the mass of the Higgs around 125 GeV. So that tells you that the following decays into all of these different states are not allowed. So if it was much heavier, the leading decays would be into these large mass states like W plus, W minus, ZZ, or TT bar. But none of those are allowed because the Higgs boson is too light. So those decays are kinematically forbidden. This is actually a good thing. So this is a very fortuitous occurrence. Didn't have to be this way. If the Higgs boson could decay into these three final states, those three states would be the only couplings we could measure in the standard model, right? Because those would give you the leading decays. All of the observations would have to do with these leading decays. But since they're forbidden kinematically, we can actually explore not just these couplings through off-shell processes, but couplings as well to other fermions. I'm not sure how to say this, but let me just say this is a good thing. So we can explore these couplings and also subleading couplings. To lighter standard model particles. Okay. So for example, things that can be measured are Higgs decays to BB bar and Higgs decays to tau tau, for example. So if the Higgs was heavier, these kinds of things would be very challenging. Now, let's compute some of these Higgs decays. So we'll start out with tree level decays. So the first one is Higgs decaying into fermion pairs, FF bar. Or let me write it like this, psi psi bar. So we need to write down the Lagrangian. The coupling is H psi bar psi. And then the coupling is just related to the mass of the fermion divided by the VeV. And then there's a minus sign. So then the Feynman rule. Is just equal to minus I m psi over v. So it's straightforward to compute the decay, the matrix element for this decay. We have I times the matrix element is minus I m psi over v. Then I have u and then v. And I'll write the momenta as p and p prime. So if I sum over the matrix elements and sum over the spins, the end result ends up being m psi squared over v squared times 4p dot p prime. And this ends up being 2 m psi squared over v squared times mh squared. Okay. So the calculation is not too complicated, but I use the fact that if I call this momentum q, q squared is p plus p prime squared. And so this is p squared plus p prime squared plus 2p dot p prime. And I'm also going to be working in the approximation that I can neglect the masses of the fermions compared to the mass of the Higgs. for these tree level decays, that's always a good approximation. For example, this might be a bottom quark. The bottom quark mass is around 4.5 GeV. The mass of the Higgs is much heavier. I can treat the bottom quark as being effectively massless. Obviously, I can't do this for the top quark, but in that case, it doesn't decay at tree level anyway. I can't neglect, of course, the overall coupling. Otherwise, it would just be zero. So this is just 2p dot p prime. And then q squared is just equal to mh squared. OK, so this is the relation that I'm using to evaluate this formula. So then I can calculate the decay rates. So it's 1 over 16 pi mh times the sum over the matrix element squared. And here I've done the two-body phase space integral, setting the mass of the fermion to 0. And so if I just plug in the matrix element squared, I get m psi squared mh over 8 pi v squared. So this is a general formula. I can just use this to evaluate different decay channels. So for example, Higgs to tau tau is m tau squared mh over 8 pi v squared. And this is around 0.26 MeV. In terms of the total branching ratio, or I should say in terms of the branching ratio, so I take this divided by the total width, turns out to be around 2.6% branching ratio. I can do a similar calculation for quarks. So let's say I have Higgs to BB bar. This is mb squared over mh over 8 pi squared v. V squared. And then there's one extra correction I need to make. Does anyone know what it is? Yes, exactly. Color. So this is only the decay rate for one particular fermion, of a given quantum number, let's say. And so if I want to sum over all possible final states, I need to sum over color. And so I need to multiply by 3. So if you compute this, if you measure this, what you'll get is around 4.3 MeV. And if you compute this, according to this formula, you won't get exactly the right answer. You'll be off by a factor of 2 or so. And the reason that you won't get quite the right answer is because of renormalization group effects. So the bottom quark mass is defined, around the scale of the bottom quark mass, around 4.5 GeV. Here, the Higgs boson is decaying. And the typical energy scales around the Higgs boson mass, 125 GeV. So you have to run the bottom quark mass from 4.5 up to the mass of the Higgs boson. And so that will decrease the value of MB. And if you plug that value in, you'll get the right answer. So this turns out to be 58% in terms of branching ratio. And so you need to take into account the RG running of MB from MB to MH. And so this suppresses MB by a factor of 2. Next, we can also do the charm quark.
When you say from MB to MH, it means like from MB, which is the scale of usual QCD, to...
Yeah, I'm not being very clear with the notation here. So in this MB, this would be the scale of the bottom quark mass, the quote-unquote bottom quark mass. That's also known as the pole mass. So this is the 4.5 GeV-ish mass. And so now when I talk about the running of MB, I'm talking about the running of the MB as a parameter in the Lagrangian, from that 4.5 GeV up to 125 GeV. So this is the parameter in the Lagrangian. Okay. And then let me write down the same expression for the charm quark mass. So I have 3 mc squared over 8 pi v squared. This is around 0.4 MeV. And in terms of branching fraction, it's 2.9%. Here, the running is even more important because we're going from around 1.5 GeV up to 125 GeV. And so the RG running suppresses MC by a factor of around 4. So for this, it's very important to put in this effect. Oh, sorry, I didn't quite mean this. It's around square root of 4. And this one also, it's a square root of 2. Sorry about that. The branching ratio is suppressed, would be suppressed by a factor of 2 and 4. Okay. I'm out of time. So tomorrow, or not tomorrow, Monday, we're going to continue with Higgs decays. We're going to talk about decays to gauge bosons. And that will be it. That'll be all.